Good evening, everybody, and thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. This is just an historic occasion. It's our very first visit from Sally Hepworth, all the way from Australia. Many of you were here when Jane Harper was here. You remember that Jane gave Sally a rave and said, not only is she a great writer, but she was hilarious. So I tried to make sure that that would be true by taking her out for alcohol. So she's at the Valley Ho, which right there is terrific. And then we've been to Virtue, where we have been wined in. Well, not dined exactly, but...
Yeah, we were dined.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, I've got her all prepped to do a wonderful conversation. Right. So Sally's here from Melbourne, Australia. Many of you have been to Australia. Any of you from Australia? Melbourne?
Some other place? I've been there.
Yeah. Have you been to Melbourne?
No. Sydney and around for my honeymoon.
Oh. It's a wonderful city. Actually, I grew up north of Chicago and Winnetka, and Melbourne reminds me of Evanston. Many of you are familiar with Evanston. It's very much the same feeling with that kind of architecture, and it's not, Sydney's very much more like New York. It's very, sort of cutting edge and modern and financial capitals and all that good stuff. But Melbourne is an older, more subtle city. Also has the best library. Maybe the best one I have ever been in, but certainly in the top five libraries I have ever been to. It's an extraordinary library.
It's the most beautiful library.
Yeah. But Scottsdale has got beautiful pools and weather.
Right. So the Hotel Valley Ho, for any of you who have been there, is the original Scottsdale Resort. It's actually where Robert Wagner and Natalie Wood got married and John Wayne used to stay. And when they redid it, gosh, I can't remember how many years ago, maybe 15 or something. Anyway, they took it back to 1955 or 56. So it is an interesting place to say.
It's amazing. Yeah. A lot of partying going on there. I felt very old.
Yeah, occasionally it has like a clutch of millennials, which is one reason we went to Virtue, because you can't even hear yourself think in the lobby. But anyway, it's an experience. It's much more fun for men because they can go home and say, I've been to the Ho. Doesn't work really as well for women. But anyway, so we are here to talk about this beautiful cover book called, the book's called The Soulmate, but I really like the jacket and the artwork and the colors. Gorgeous. Did you have any input into that?
No. Except to say that I really, really liked it. But I am pretty good at sticking to my writing of the books. And I've been so lucky with the jackets of my books. And almost every time it has been an immediate, I love it. And maybe once or twice there's been a little bit of amending in the US. And then it's gone ahead. I've had a few more arguments with the Australian publishers.
Well, every country has its own idea of what will work. Yeah. I get Allen & Unwin's. There's an Australian publisher called Allen & Unwin, which is very...
We call it Allen & Onion.
Okay. And they have a really nice newsletter, but it's fun because I can see that Michael Connelly, for example, looks totally different in his Australian packaging, than he does in the U.S. And as publishing's becoming more global, it's really fun to sort of keep up with what works in other countries and so forth. So this is Sally's eighth published book. And we had a brief conversation about unpublished books, which presumably are not going to be published. Maybe not ever.
I hope not, because I don't want anyone to read them.
But I'm fascinated. Are any Canadians here tonight? No. So Sally let me know, I'm really stunned to hear this and envious, that if you become pregnant in Canada and you're employed, you get a 1 year maternity leave. Wow, how forward thinking is that? We don't get any
paid.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I forgot the paid part.
Maternity leave, it's unbelievable.
It really is. And so there she was with a baby and not working in free time, although I still... I've had children. How much free time with a baby did you actually have?
I always say that I could only have done it with my son, who's just turned 14. He's turned 14 while I've been here in the States. And I call him my robot child because he's never met a routine that he didn't like. And even as a baby, he would sleep for 3 hours at nap time. Oh. And so I could only write that book because of my robot baby. And when I meet new mothers who want to write a book, I say, just don't feel bad if you don't have a robot baby. Your baby controls you, not the other way.
It's amazing nobody put a hit out on you.
Very true.
I mean, I had puppies during the pandemic, and I wanted like to have 300 uninterrupted puppy hours.
Unless they were robot puppies. Unless they were robot puppies.
And no, they were not robot puppies. They're more grown-up puppies, but still. Actually, I was wishing the other day that they were still puppies because I kind of missed that, you know, and they would be there. They'd stand up on their little tiny hind legs and you could see them going, mom, 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 you know, feed me or whatever. And I kind of missed that. But there it is. Right. Anyway, so talk to us about what inspired you to write, since we've never had a chance to hear your career story before.
Yeah. So do you mean the soulmate, or do you mean just
in general? We'll get to the soulmate, yeah. But we have an hour to kill, so we have plenty of time to go later.
So it's funny because my mum is very fond of saying now that she always knew that I was going to be an author, and hindsight is a wonderful thing because I keep saying to her, well, that's great, mum, but why didn't you tell me when I was in my 20s and desperately searching for my career? We were talking before about how I left school, I did an arts degree, which, not to be confused with painting, creative kind of art, which I am no good at, even though I tell people not to say that because, you know, everyone's good at it. But I did literature and history at university, which was in the long term a very good career that gave me great general knowledge for life. It kind of, I came out of it and didn't know what to do. So I did what every Australian person does, and that is go overseas. And I went and I lived in London for 2 years with my 2-year working holiday visa. And I came back, I met my husband, we moved to Canada, I became pregnant. And then I thought, maybe I will try and write a book, because I had always loved to write, and even more than even just writing it down, I'd always loved storytelling. And it was funny because last night in Houston, a bunch of my workmates who I used to work with in Canada came, they now are in Houston, and they came and surprised me. And they said, you were always telling a story at work, Sally. You know, I remember when we'd eat lunch and we would be in the boardroom and you would regale us in stories about something. And I thought, isn't that funny? Because that's so true. That's, I just love to entertain people through whatever means I have possible. And so it was books. When I was on my gloriously paid maternity leave and I had my robot baby, and I thought, I'm going to give this a crack and I'm going to try and write a novel. So I did, and I don't think I could have done it before we had the internet, the World Wide Web, as I like to call it. Because I started by Googling how to write a novel. And, I mean, it was the most wonderful thing because Google has answers for you. And it had many, many answers. And one of them, and don't write this down if you're an aspiring author, because I've never used this method again, but there was a method called the snowflake method. And it gave you instructions that the first thing you do is you write a sentence about what your book is about. Then you turn it into a paragraph, and then you write a sentence about what each chapter is about. And I loved the confidence of having instructions that, right, now I'm going to do the next thing. And following those instructions, I got to the end of a book, which felt quite miraculous, because I kind of thought, if I start writing a book, I'm going to write some words, I'm going to be not sure where they're going, and eventually I'll putter out and that will be the end of it. But there was this glorious confidence that came with finishing a novel and believing, you know, very inaccurately, that it was quite good and that it resembled a novel, you know, with, you know, a beginning and a middle and an end. And I knew by the end of that book that it was something that I just really wanted to do. Unfortunately, I'd used up my year of maternity leave at that point, and we had moved back to Australia. And so I searched for an agent while working part-time. I had another baby and was just writing furiously in between. And it was my third book, which was The Secrets of Midwives, which became the first book that was published in Australia and around the world. And you know, the rest is history.
So you haven't mentioned your role as gossip girl in the HR department, which probably gave you some practice in telling stories, right?
And also the great material. So, and this is why I say often to aspiring authors who are kind of fresh out of, you know, school or who want to write, there is something to be said for a bit of life experience. And my previous career after university, which was in human resources, really served me well as someone who loves gossip. And also I like to know how much everyone is paid, and I like to know who's in trouble for stuff, you know, who's on their final warning. And so that was just a glorious, glorious thing that gave me so much fodder for my books. And in fact, that first terrible book did feature a gossipy woman who worked in HR and was interested in how much people are paid. But I've kind of blocked all that out of my life until all of my former work colleagues came last night and started reminding me of some of the things that I did. And it made me so grateful that I was able to make a career of writing novels, because I may not have made it back into the HR.
I think after you accidentally sent the spreadsheets, the spreadsheet with everybody's salary all around the company, then it would have been difficult to continue your career.
I was very pregnant in my defense that day. I accidentally emailed everyone's salary, and then I quickly took my maternity leave and just put my head down.
True, and it wasn't a murder mystery, which it could have been. And
it's true.
You was the victim, but there we are. So we're actually here to talk about The Soulmate, and that's a really interesting title. Why did you decide to call it The Soulmate? I'm assuming that you had some input, because actually authors don't get to choose their own titles most of the time. So maybe it wasn't your choice.
It wasn't my choice, but it wasn't. I was happy with it. So what happened, which is what has happened with every one of my books, except for The Mother-in-Law, is that I usually have a working title, which I very arbitrarily pluck out of the air and just pop into the book. And sometimes it's something like, so my second book, The Things We Keep, I very inappropriately just called the dementia book the whole way through writing it. And my friend Lisa Ireland, who's a very good friend of mine, she had one book that she used to say, this is such a bad book, it's a real turkey. You know, I don't know if you say that here, if something's bad, oh, it's a turkey. Yeah, so she called that the turkey book. It was called that in the end. But these are our working titles. And so this book, The Soulmate, when I was writing it, I called it The Cliff in my mind, which is very unimaginative for me. If you can see the front cover and read the first page, you can see why I called it The Cliff. And as I wrote it, it actually wasn't a bad title, because it kept pulling me back to the book. And so, I mean, this is probably a good time to tell you, the book is about many things. It's about my most favourite dysfunctional relationship, which is marriage, because I do enjoy writing about dysfunctional relationships. And this whole story takes place on the edge of a cliff. Pippa and Gabe have got a little cottage. They live there, and they don't realise until after they move in that this cliff is famous for people who want to go and take their own lives, which is terrible and not something that you want to discover after you've bought your dream home. But they managed to turn it around by Gabe making his life's work out of talking people away from the ledge.
Out of jumping.
Yeah, and he's really good at it. And so and from there, the first chapter has a woman coming to the cliff, and in the year before that, seven people have come to the cliff, all seven have walked away. And at the first chapter of the book, a woman comes to the cliff, number eight, and she is out there, Gabe is talking to her, and his wife Pippa is watching through the window, and she notices that he's acting a little bit differently, and he's going a little bit closer than he would normally go. He's waving his hands around a little bit like they're having an argument. And then something steals her attention and she looks away. And when she looks back, the woman has gone over the cliff, and Gabe's hands are kind of unusually like he might have pushed her. So the cliff, obviously, as my working title, was very, you know, it made sense to me that was the placement of where it all takes place, but it also became a kind of metaphor for what can push us over the cliff in marriage. And it's not always the kind of dramatic, you know, hopefully husbands aren't pushing people off cliffs, you know, all over the place, but who knows? But also there are things that people discover about their relationship that could be another woman or man, if the other way around, it could be, you know, maybe a deceit, a financial deceit, or it could be, you know, just something that has made them discover that their partner isn't who they thought they were. And that, in a sense, is a cliff that they start to go down. So I warmed to the title, The Cliff. And so I actually was a little bit disappointed when it was unanimously poo-pooed by publishers all over the world, in Australia and in the US and in the UK. And there was a period where they were all arguing, all of the publishers amongst themselves, on what they thought the title should be. And I just sat back with my popcorn and I waited to see, you know, if an agreement would be reached. And I can't remember who proposed The Soulmate, but I really liked it because, A, it referred to the relationship in question. And as I said, I always write about a particular family relationship, and you can see that in all of the titles: the mother-in-law, the good sister, the younger wife, and so this, of course, points to that romantic love with the word soulmate. But also, the word soul refers to Amanda. So the second part of the book that I haven't told you about, Amanda is the woman who's come to the cliff that night, and at the beginning of the book, she has gone over the cliff and she's dead. But we then move forward and we find out the backstory of her relationship as well, her marriage, and we hear that from her posthumously, which is a word that I practice saying several times. It means from death, but you all know that because you're much smarter than I am. So the word soul as well did double duty from her being a soul. And something else I didn't know was that when someone takes their life, in the media, they're referred to as souls. I don't know if that's the same here, but they'll say, you know, many souls lost their life at this cliff. And so it just felt like the right title, even though I can take zero credit for how it came to be on the jacket.
At least you didn't block it.
No, I didn't block it. I was enthusiastic.
Yeah, that part's pretty good. So if you're going to tell this kind of a story, if you're writing like a police procedural or a private eye story or something, the action unfolds forward. You have the instigating incident, right? And then you pursue the investigation towards the end. And you do discover things about people, but the forward motion. But if you're going to tell this kind of a story, you're basically unpicking the past. You're peeling the onion. So you start with something, but instead of going forward very much, you go backwards and come forward. So is that a structure that you really like?
It is, and it's, you know, it's not my, I mean, we've seen it in lots of, Jane Harper does it really, really well. Leanne Moriarty did it so successfully in Big Little Lies and other stories. I love playing with structure, and one of the first things I think about when I get a novel idea is, how am I going to do this?
Right.
And I'm trying to think of a new book idea at the moment, and I told you part of a story which I think something that happened to me on the way here at LA airport, which I think may form the beginning.
It cries out, it does cry out for the book. You know, for a writer, everything's material. No matter what bad things happen to you, if you just report them, you can use them.
Everything,
but yeah, you're absolutely right. It would make a great beginning for, well, sorry, we were drinking, so
I can tell you that story, but yeah. But to answer your question, as soon as I get an idea, I'll get a little kernel of, you know, what if I told a story about marriage? What if I told a story about? And then I think, well, who are the players? Whose perspective are we going to hear from? And how are we going to structure it? You know, where is this dramatic experience going to happen? And in The Soulmate, it's right up front. And in other, a more traditional structure will be, you know, three quarters of the way in, the kind of worst moment. But it's one of those fun things that we get to play with as an author. whilst also being really careful to not trick a reader either, because there's nothing worse when you know that a character that knows stuff just hasn't revealed that. So you've got a what's the word? You've got like an agreement with a reader. Once they've read a few of your books and they know who you are and what they're getting, you can't betray them. And I think that's something that I haven't talked that much about.
Publicly. It's kind of a contract.
It's a contract.
Yeah, you're right. There's exactly. An expectation. I know Janet Ivanovich and I, when we were on book like 27, had that conversation, because basically every Stephanie Plum's like every other Stephanie Plum, right? But she feels that that's the contract she has with her reader, is to produce that experience over and over again with some variations, because that's what they, you know, come to expect from her. I think a consequence of this kind of a book is that it's you really don't write sequels. You know, when it's very difficult to take this kind of a story and carry on with these characters. You know, you start somewhere and you take them on this journey and you get to whatever resolution there is, but then you're done. Essentially, you're going to leave them to get on with their lives while you go to LAX and try a whole different approach. So have you ever been interested in pursuing your characters in a second book?
Until very recently, the answer was no. And I would have, my usual answer, my canned answer that I prepared earlier that I'm about to undo is that, and because it's true, is that these characters that form in my mind, they form for this story. And they are the characters that are going to be the most challenged by this particular set of circumstances that's going to be thrown at them. Because then they're going to grow and change, because that's what we want to see as readers. We want to see people overcome something difficult and be better at the end, or be worse, or, you know, just be changed at the end. But a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called The Good Sister, and there's a character in it called Fern, the main character, who is a librarian, and she is on the spectrum, and she is just so dear to my heart, and I keep thinking about her, and I keep thinking that maybe, I don't know, like it might even be a prequel, it might even be something that happened before the book started. It's the first time, and I think I've heard other authors say that. They always said, no, I won't do it, and then I feel like I could concoct another.
Right. I had this conversation with Lisa Jewell with her last book. She never wanted to write the same set of characters again, but her book list, September, whichever it was, anyway, last year, was in fact a continuation of a, and it was The Family Upstairs,
the
right? And then, which one was first? I'm sorry.
The Family Upstairs.
Was first, and then what was
the Family Remains.
The Family Remains. Okay, so even the title reflected that. Yeah. And I asked her if she would ever do it again. She said no.
Really?
Yeah, she did. But she was interested enough in where she left those characters in The Family Upstairs, where she saw the possibility of another story. Now, I think your idea of a prequel actually might be easier, you know, because then you know, you're not following on, but you're doing something that will eventually get these characters to the place where they started with whatever incident kicks off.
Yes, although I don't know, for there is a real readership of this book and who love Fern, which makes me so happy, because she is a neurodiverse character, and and that is a big part of who I am in my family. I have two autistic kids. I have ADHD. My husband's on the spectrum. We're, you know, and it's so rewarding to create, you know, a beloved neurodiverse character. And I know that a lot of the people who love that book will want to know what happened to her. So I think they may not be happy with it.
Because they want to make it.
Well, that's true.
So I think it's interesting, you know, you are published in Australia, the United States, England, and God knows where else, you know. Do you find that your stories translate to all these different countries and cultures without people going, what the hell was that?
That's such a good question, because I didn't know if they would. And in fact, my contract initially is with America. So I wrote my books in Canada and then Australia. I found an American agent who then sold my book to St. Martin's Press in New York. And so even though I have an Australian contract, it's a foreign right. So to my Australian publishers, I'm like a foreigner, which they think is very funny. But so I deal with my American publisher, and my first three books were set in America. And each time I would say to my publisher, can I set it in Australia? And she'd say, oh, I don't know. I don't know if the readers will come along with you. And so I did another one in America. And then, and meanwhile, Jane Harper, Leanne Moriarty, you know, there were people doing really good work from Australia. And it was with my fourth book, The Family Next Door, that she said, go on, write a book set in Australia. And that, I think, was where my books kind of took off, in spite of or because, I don't know. There have been several things that have surprised me that have tripped up American readers, and there have been things that have surprised me that haven't. So, for example, and I don't think this ever made it to the book because my publisher was so, you know, discombobulated by it. It's my favourite word, discombobulated. This book, The Family Next Door, was set in a cul-de-sac, and so there were people coming in and out of driveways, and there were lots of children in the street playing and things. And every time someone would reverse their car out of their driveway, they would beep the horn. Now, she said, why is everyone beeping their horn on the street? I said, well, because they're good neighbours, because you don't want to run over a child. And I don't know if any of you, but that might be a uniquely Australian thing, that you have to pip your horn before you reverse out, because otherwise you'll kill a child. So that confused everyone, and I don't think it made it into the American version.
Well, in the first place, we wouldn't be reversing out.
Oh, because
we'd be backing up.
Oh, you would back into your driveway.
No, but you would back out of the driveway. Reversing is not.
It's not a thing.
No, it is. It's what you do, but it's not what you call it.
You would just back.
Right.
But you can still kill that way.
Yeah.
Which is another kind of book. But
true.
There was another one. So in The Good Sister, for example, there's this really weird, unexplainable thing. I don't know, maybe it happens somewhere in America, but Australians love nicknames. And we love nicknames especially that make no sense to anything or anyone. And, for example, one of my brother's best friends, these are 45-year-old men, is known to everyone as Perps. Perps. And the reason he's called Perps is that one day when they were about 8 and they were on the train to school, this guy, Patrick is his name, was so cold that he turned purple. And so now everyone called this 45-year-old, including his parents, Perps. And that is just something that's really common. And in The Good Sister, Fern meets this man whose name is Rocco, and when she first meets him, he's wearing a red and white striped t-shirt and a pair of glasses, and she says, oh, hello, Wally. And he says, and she says, oh, you look like where's Wally? So that, I thought, that's going to be confusing, A, because I don't think Americans give people weird nicknames like that, and B, you guys call him Waldo, right?
Yeah.
So it's not even, it's a double. And do you know what? No one has questioned it. And lots of Americans come up to me and they say, we love Wally. Oh, he was so great. And I think, yes. I didn't think that one would translate. And when I press people, they've said, oh, yeah, I'm a little confused. We just went with it. He was just Wally. So I think sometimes you can, I don't know, something comes across in the, that maybe they don't get it as a concept, but the characters make it real or something.
I'm convinced that the internet eventually we're all going to have one language or, you know, one cultural reference or something, because in fact it does. Yeah, I mean, they talk, you know, in England about, you know, how Oxford and Cambridge have their own language and people go there and they language. I remember when I went to Stanford, I got there from Chicago, and people in California, this is long before the internet, so it was 1958, and they used to say to me, say car. Because I had that Midwest A, you know, they were going car in California. I'm going car, you know, and I mean, and that people would laugh hilariously at my terrible language and, you know, whatever. But now that doesn't really, you know, you don't see that regional stuff very much anymore, because we're all, you know, with movies and television and internet and so forth, they, a lot of that regional stuff is going away.
It's become more homogenous, and I feel like I've been educated on a steady diet of American television since I was a very young child. And now I know that when I go to Starbucks, I have to say my name is Sally, You know, you go hard on the A, whereas if I say Sally, then I'll get Sully or Tully.
Huh.
But, and I, this is my third book tour in America, and now I just roll straight up to Starbucks and I say, I will have a hot latte for Sally.
Sounding like my Midwestern A. Okay. That's it, right? I will say this, that the first time that I went to Australia, I rolled into a bookstore and I could hardly believe, first, there was very little native publishing in Australia at that point.
Yeah.
So almost all the books are American, and with paperbacks for $35 a piece. Australian dollars, but still, you know, because everything was shipped in. Now, your publisher, St. Martin's, is actually a Dutch holding company called Van Holspring, which comes from England, called Macmillan. So in point of fact, it really is an international conglomerate. And, you know, the fact that you are publishing with the New York version is kind of irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because they actually shipped their books from London to Australia for forever until they developed a printing process in Australia. So New Zealand is actually still behind Australia. They have not yet developed quite as much local publishing and so forth, but they're working on it.
They're getting there, but yeah. They are behind Australia.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's freaking up. So, but meantime, a huge amount of what they get still comes from the UK.
Yeah.
You know, so UK rights are South Africa and New Zealand, usually Australia. I can't remember where all, a whole bunch of places.
This is why I was so excited that this week, now I'm going to be blowing my own trumpet. Is that an expression that you have? Yeah.
Yes.
To be on the New York Times, basically tooting your own horn. To be on the New York Times bestseller list, but with my friend Kate Norton, who's also Australian. So,
that's right.
And it's so, and with Jane Harper, Leanne Moriarty, like I feel like.
There's a whole Australian crime wave.
Yeah.
Right again, crime wave that has been rising. I said that 2 years ago, that we, the Scandinavian thing, the Nordic Noir thing, was just so overwhelming, and we've all been reading dark Scandinavian stuff for so long. You know, with weird cults out in the frozen north and, you know, serial killers and all this other weird stuff, that we were going to have an Australian crime wave. And indeed, we are.
Yeah, I heard someone say both about my books, but also Leanne Moriarty's, and Jane's got a bit of this. That Australians write funny books about terrible things. And I thought, oh, that's cool. Yeah, I think that could be an Australian. Yeah.
Actually, there's a sort of a Western thing. A lot of Australian crime fiction is really basically like American Westerns, and so not, you know, easily. But about Jane, in fact, was there a third book? I think it's the third one that's, you know, yeah, which is fabulous for those who read Jane Harper, The Dry, and then there was the one up in Queensland where it was all, you know, kind of wet. But then the third one was basically a Western.
Yes, exactly. In the middle of the deep countryside where, you know, you had to go and do your grocery shopping for 3 months worth and have, you know, it all in a, like almost a supermarket in your house.
There's also a fair amount of Australian television for those of you who might watch Acorn or BritBox. There have been some terrific Australian TV series. And so,
thank you
that,
for flying the flag here.
I was telling Sally that I have a nephew who lives in Melbourne, a Chinese doctor from birth. So I have nieces, a niece and a nephew who are Australian, and they all live in Melbourne. And then if you remember, Poison Pen Press published Kerry Greenwood. I mean, we sold the press, so it's not us anymore. But Kerry Greenwood and Sir Larry Gentle are both our authors. And another really interesting and extremely eccentric author called J.M. Donnellan. Have you run across him?
No.
Well, he's an Australian author, and he has a new book coming out. And he wrote an earlier one, which was Strangest. It was sort of a Australian country house Agatha Christie serial killer. All at once.
With strange people.
But really, no, I mean, a very odd book, but nonetheless. So you know, we've been to visit Kerry and visit Savari and other stuff, so. Lots of time in Australia, although more time in New Zealand, which, you know, everybody thinks they're in the same place, but New Zealand is 3.5 hours closer to the United States. So if you're looking at flying, it's the same time to fly to Auckland, New Zealand, as it is to fly from Phoenix to London. Every time I say how much I love New Zealand, people say it's so far. Actually, it's the same time as flying to London. And it is from here.
So while you're there, come to Australia as
well. Right. Then you can just hop on everything.
But New Zealand is beautiful. People think that there is a rivalry between Australia and New Zealand, and I mean, as an Australian, we're just so proud of New Zealand. You know? it's like our little cousin, you know. It's so beautiful, and you know, it's a magnificent place to be.
So back to the cliffside. just, you know, jerking your hand to the bar here for a few minutes, but suicide's a hard thing to write about. And years ago, I think it was Ripley Pearson, but it might have been Marsha Muller. Anyway, whichever one of them was writing about San Francisco Bay, we were doing an event, had done some research and pointed out, I still remember this, that every person who has jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge has jumped off facing San Francisco. Not one person has leapt off the bridge facing the Pacific Ocean, they can tell. You know, and I thought, wow, that, not kidding, isn't that really a fun, and so, but thinking about your clip, there's only one way to go. There's one way to look. You don't have that kind of choice. And, you know, there are British mysteries where people go off cliffs as well. I mean, first place, you have to be on the ocean in order to have a cliff in order to do that. But I still remember what does it say about us and about suicide that would be the case, that your last view would be of San Francisco and not the Pacific?
Yeah.
That may no longer be true, because I think I had that conversation 20 years ago, but nonetheless.
Was it a logistical thing about that?
No.
No,
if you were on the Golden Gate Bridge, you had a choice. You know, you could one side or the other. I mean, so many suicide plots. There's a bridge in England by Bristol, and that's another place where, you know, there's something about bridges where people like to, you know, leap off into the unknown, but maybe not entirely into the unknown. Is the point, you know, maybe there's a sort of still. So when you decided to write about these people, do you talk at all about, because this is all in the very beginning, about why any of those people would have come to the suicide spot and what is it that Gabe says to them to dissuade them from jumping?
Yeah, so there were, one of the pieces of inspiration that went into this book was a real news article that I read about a man who lived the book takes place in a place called Portsea, which is in Victoria, where I live. I live in Melbourne, which is the city, and Portsea is just kind of a couple of hours down the beach, and it's a place that you go and take vacation. My parents now live there, and I spent a lot of summers growing up. But it was inspired by an article that I read about a man who had just died, but he had grown up and had lived his whole life living opposite a place called The Gap in Sydney. And The Gap is famous for people taking their own lives. And it has this long, kind of amazing, sad, but also amazing history. And it has never been able to have any kind of barrier put up because of where it's located and the erosion. It can't be blocked off. Several things have been tried, like having cameras there, having, phones that, you know, people can call, but really nothing has been that successful. There's a really famous story of a woman who went there in like 1920, and she went to the cliff, and she decided, I can't remember why, but there's a whole story about why she decided to take her own life. And as she leapt off the cliff, she changed her mind, and she was in the air, and it was too late, and no one's ever survived this jump. And it was this freak thing where, because underneath the cliff is rocks, and there's this freak thing where this wave came in and she survived. And she went on to live until she was 90-something. She had children and grandchildren. She became an actress, and she spoke a lot about this experience. And people saw it, and it was just this kind of freak thing. Anyway, that brings us to this man who I think his name was Roy. I really should have looked it up and known this before it was on the internet, but let's call him Roy. And he had a job and everything, but he'd grown up since he was a little boy, and at some point he'd started to see people over the cliff. And it was across a road in real life, and then he could see it from his house. And he would walk over, and he would say to someone who was standing there, "Can I help you with anything?" And he didn't speak about why he said that, you know, what was behind it, but he had the most extraordinary success with talking people down. And initially he'd apparently got in trouble from the services that said you have to call us and, you know, we're trained and things, but they found that Roy was having, you know, incredible success with talking people down, and practically speaking, he was often just the first one to get there. And so on the occasion of his death, this article was written about, it was estimated 500 lives that he'd saved over the course of his life, and also some stories about ones that he didn't save, and stories like there was a man who he had terrible gambling addiction, and he'd come because he'd lost everything and he didn't want to go and tell his wife or his family. And Roy had sat with him all day, and he, you know, thought he was making some progress, and he went a bit closer. And finally the man jumped, and Roy put out his hand because he just, you know, that inclination as a human, you know, even though he'd been told don't do that, you know, don't. And the man's hat flew off, and the man fell, but he caught his hat. And there were just stories like that, and it was the articles that you read or the conversations that you have that make the kind of, you know, the hair stand up, that make me think, oh, this feels like something, you know, needs to be written about this, or something's going to come out about this. So, yeah, I did, but I then transported the idea of the gap to Portsea, because I didn't want to leave people and name a place where people would then, you know, publicise a place where people might go to take their own lives. I'm much more familiar with the place of Portsea, and while there is a cliff there, it isn't a kind of cliff that you would die or that you could really jump on. It's more of a dune. So I read about people who do that, as well as this man's stories. And the kind of psychological feedback was that anything you can do to take someone out of that moment of contemplating their life, whether it be, can I help you, look at that beautiful sunset is another thing, you know, look over there, and just to connect with people, it doesn't always work, but it can be profoundly impactful for people.
So this is not a book about suicide. This is how this book starts. So yeah. I don't want to give you the wrong impression. It's reading about the story of this marriage. And, you know, and of course the question is, did the woman jump or didn't she? But I didn't want to, you know, leave you with a wrong impression. But
no, that's right. And that is the only, so at the beginning of the book, we know that Gabe in the book has been very successful at talking people down. And then there is this incident in the first chapter where someone comes, and that is what kickstarts all of the questions in the book.
Yeah. All right. So, about questions from any of you, since you haven't had a chance to ask Sally questions before, have at it.
But I just would love it if you could talk a little bit about the dance you have to do between being an author and an influencer, right? Because you do it very well. I mean, even like my husband, when I left, he's like, hey, tell Sally I said hi, and that we'll work on the colored money situation.
Oh, great. I appreciate that.
So he's not read a word of your books, but he follows you because I make him on Instagram. And so he's like, we'll see what we can do about our green money. But anyhow, I think that there's got to be, while you do such an amazing job at that, there's got to be there's an intentionality. It's not as easy as you make it look. I know that. And how do you like deal with that headspace, right? Because it's one thing, you know, you've got to be writing dialogue for Pippa and Gabe, but then you also have to be creating content and doing all of this other stuff. So how do you balance that? And I think also, like, I think that could be intimidating for aspiring authors to know that, like, I can't in this day and age just write.
So any thoughts? Yes. So what's your name?
Kristen.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. And I get that a lot. I get questions about that a lot. And Kristen's referring to, I do have quite a big social media following as well as writing the books. And it is something that, you know, I know that a lot of aspiring authors feel a big pressure that they have to, if they've written a book, go to a publisher with, you know, 40,000 followers. I don't think that's true. And I think that while you have to evolve with publishing and, you know, things do change and you do have to market yourself more than you once did, different things work for different people. And for me, I do find social media easy. So I'll full disclosure, I have an assistant who does all of the things that don't require my face. So if they're like the tour, you know, the little graphics that have the date and stuff on them, she does those things, and she knows when to post it, and it's just glorious. all of the things that have me watching my husband do something weird in the garden. None of that is planned. I love it when people say, what's your social media strategy? I think, I just look out the window and see something funny and I video it. On tour, it's so easy because I'm not writing a book while I'm on tour. I'm literally here. I have all this time in airports and in, you know, meeting people. And I am constantly delighted by things that happen, like the money thing. So the money thing, all of your money is green. And in Australia, we have different, you know, different colour money. So a 50 is orange and then a, like 20 is pink and then a 10 is blue. And now you guys have this tipping thing, right? So we don't tip in Australia, not because we're cheap. I mean, maybe it is, but the whole system is different. So people are paid more, so the tip is kind of included. And so I come to America and I'm like, I want to be a good tipper. I want to like show everyone the money, but I'm like getting out. I don't know if I'm giving them a 20 or a 100 or a 1. I'm just, you know, making it rain. So those kind of things are, and I'm tipping everyone. Who needs a tip and who do I tip? You know, do I need to give Barbara a tip? Like, no.
Scrap you back off its belly. Yeah. I'm going to hit my hand out.
Who knows what you'll get? It's like a water. And so those kind of things, I'm like, I just, and I'm alone. And so I want to tell someone, you know, the money here is mad. And honestly, that is how a lot of it happens. You use the word influencer, and I'm always... And not that I'm bothered by the word influencer, but I'm always careful to not use it because I made a choice at one point when my social media following started to grow, where people were starting to offer to send me things and people were starting to offer to pay me to do something, you know, a post about toothpaste or something. And I had to think, I could do that if I wanted to. I mean, you know, if people want to see it. But it's not what I want to do. Like I wanted to become an author. That's my first love. And so I decided, no, I don't do any paid advertising. I don't do anything that has a requirement. And so people do send me things. They might send me a dress and say, maybe you'll wear this on your tour. And maybe I will, maybe I won't. I don't ever take any money for it. I don't agree to do it. And so that helps me to keep the commitment low, you know. I do love to support female-run small business because they don't have big marketing budgets, and if I can wear a dress and that's going to be helpful for them, I mean, it's a win-win. And so I always have that view that my job is being an author. I'm the sole breadwinner of our family. My husband is the stay-at-home parent to our three kids, and that's how I make the most money, is writing the books. And the social media has just been a really fun adjunct to it. It's helped me to sell the books. It's a way that I can connect authentically, where I don't fancy it up with, you know, making life look perfect. And it's been a real gift. But if that isn't your thing, if there's any aspiring authors here, you can do podcasts, you can write pieces for, you know, a newsletter. There are so many ways that you can connect with people, and finding what works for you that doesn't take up any of your time and helps you focus on the books is the right one for you.
You'll notice that the poison pen doesn't take any advertising. Very designer quite well, but I'm not. But no, we made the same decision. So basically, Patrick and I are influencers, but we do it. You can trust us in the sense that we are not being coerced or paid or bribed to do anything.
Yeah.
We don't even have a marketing budget. You've never seen an advertisement for the poison pen. Not anywhere. So I write to you instead. Patrick writes to you. We all write to you. I mean, it's very interesting.
And then how do you know
it?
About the poison pen? Because someone tells you there's this great bookstore and, you know, isn't it wonderful? And they know their stuff about books, and that, you know, word of mouth is amazing.
But it's authors like you who also, you know, talk about the store. And, you know, so you are our influencers.
Well, I'll influence for the poison pen, and I don't take money. Everyone is wild about the poison pen in Australia. And when Jane was coming here and she said, oh, are you going to the poison pen? And we were like squealing. And I'm like, how can we work it out so we can come together? Because I was picturing us like on one of those sun lounges with a cocktail. Everyone,
that's a really good idea to try to coordinate. You know, we do a lot of events with Australian authors and New Zealand authors. I had a wonderful moment in January. I mentioned the author or the publisher, but anyway, it was a New Zealand author, and I was asked to take a look at it for various purposes. I did, and I liked it. And I said, well, now that I've read it, maybe we should do a Zoom event. And the New York publisher actually said to me, but you can't. He's in New Zealand.
Oh.
It was a moment when I sort of took a breath. And I said, well, here's the thing. If it's 4 o'clock in Australia, it's 10 o'clock in Auckland. The next day, you just have to make the jump, you know. But I was really so surprised by that. Yeah.
If you bring Jane and I here, I think the Harpworth tour would have another spring to it.
That sounds wonderful. I want a little bigger space than the one we're currently in, should you want to do that. I don't know if you all have watched any of the interviews I've done with Michael Verbotham, for example, who's a two-time Gold Digger winner that lives in Sydney. We've done a whole bunch of, trying to think, Patrick, what else have we done? You think Australia, there was two St. Martin's authors, debut authors. One was New Zealand and one was Australia, and I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember.
There was that tour, and there were four of them.
Well, that was from Larry. They got a grant from the Australian government, actually. Dervla. I don't think she was part of it. It was Suari and a woman from Perth whose name
Emma.
Two men.
Isik, is it?
Emma Fisick. Is it?
Yes, that's who it was. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, how fun. I want to come with all of
them. And I'm going to say that Australia has serious time zone issues, so to actually think that you could just do Australia. But here's the thing. Perth is a long way in a different time zone than Melbourne and Sydney, so you even have to overcome, you know, the time gaps. But what a wonderful tool it is then, you know. So if people know us in Australia, it's because we're actually doing stuff in Australia.
And everyone wants to come to Scottsdale.
Well, there's that. There is that, for sure. Patrick, are there any questions from the virtual audience?
Not as many as you'd think. There is an interesting question. Ivana is her name, and she says, Sally said that she worked in HR, but was she a big reader and that led to her wanting to write a book?
Yes, that's a great question. Always been a very big reader. I used to read. My mum always says that I used to read before I could read because I have older brothers, and I would get out their readers and I would, you know, say, this is a cat, you know, this is a
root. This is Jane, this is Spots. Yeah. Spot Run. Do you all remember seeing Spot Run? Works the first read.
Yeah, so always reading. My mum is a teacher and so was so lucky to be surrounded by books and it was going to the library, and it was when I was working in HR and I read a book by Emily Giffen called Something Thorough, which I think was her first book, and I was in the middle of it and I thought, I remember something happens right at the end of the first chapter and I thought, oh, you know, you feel that, oh, I'm in, oh, this happened so quickly, that just sort of delightful feeling. And at some point, during that book, I thought, I'd like to do this. And it wasn't long after that I started writing my first book. But here's a cool story. Jennifer Enderlin was the publisher who published that book, Something Borrowed. And I discovered that because I then, you know, was obsessed with Emily Giffen and obsessed with everything to do with her and her publisher. And then, I don't know, 7 years later, when I got my first book published, Jennifer Enderlin was the publisher of my book. And last year, when I was in an event in Pawleys Island in South Carolina, I was interviewed by Emily Giffen, and Jennifer Enderlin, our publisher, was in the audience. And I was able to say, this is how it all started. And like, who would have thought that we would be sitting here? It was an amazing
It's pretty moment. Yeah. My Emily is an Instagram activist. Every time I turn around, there is another Emily. She's the one that blacks the royal family and often is, if you watch it, multiple. She never posts one. I don't even know how to do that. I'm not smart enough on Instagram, but she'll put up one photo and then you just keep swiping and there's like 10.
Yeah.
You know, of the royal family. Someday I'm going to learn how to do that.
I did an event with her last Friday in Atlanta. So that was our second event.
Very nice. Right. Anybody else have a question?
So your characters are always extremely well-rounded. You always have like really awesome characteristics, but they also have like individual issues. I just wanted to know if you have like a process when it comes to like getting the perfect personality for your characters, because I feel like they always come with a really good message to learn at the end as well.
Thank you. I thought you were going to say, I was just wondering if you have deep personal issues to creating characters like this. The answer is yes. No, I don't. Like with the social media, I'm very bad at things like process. And I have diagnosed ADHD, and which is a blessing and a curse, because, you know, one of the wonderful things about ADHD is that it gives you hyper-focus, so you can become zoned in on something. And luckily for me, that was writing books. And the less good side of it is that I've now forgotten your question. What was it? We couldn't script it that. About characters. I know. Sorry, going back.
No.
So when it comes to things like characters, plot, like I'm always bamboozled when people ask me, so, you know, tell me about your process. How do you write a book? And I kind of blink at them like, I don't know how to answer that. It's a little bit like if someone said, what do you do for a job? How do you work at a school? You know, like it's like, what do you mean? Like, I don't know. Like, I do a series of things and I, you know, you get there and you get out of your car and you go in and then there are kids. Like, for you, I imagine. And for me, you know, I sit at my computer and I do have things in place. But so much of it, and particularly the more books I go through, because from that first snowflake method where I was like, you know, that was not the case. But now so much of it is gut feel, and I just feel like I know, and I don't always get it right the first time or even the fifth time, but I get a feel, even if I've had a plan for the book, I'll think this character is snore, this is boring, you know, this maybe something really exciting or terrible happened to them, and like I'll be in chapter 5 and like, oh, that's it, that's what it is. Or it might be at the end that I realize this is the transformation, so now I have to go back and kind of, you know, seed that in earlier. And that's part of the unraveling for me, whereas Jane, who is much smarter and better at stuff than me, she has done a TED talk. If you want to know about process, she's done a TED talk about how to write a novel. And I always tell people when they ask me how to do it, go and watch Jane because she knows. But
that only works for Jane.
Yes.
You know, exactly. It doesn't really transfer. Lee Child has a new thing I just saw on Instagram today. He's got like, you know, 9 bullet points or whatever to writing a thriller, and you know, it'll work for Lee, but it isn't necessarily going to work for any of you because your brain works differently.
Exactly. And we're all different. And I think the more books you write, you realize that you can't do it like anyone else. You know, you might, and we all want to know, like we all, you know, authors who are success, Jane and Leanne Moriarty, we'll sit and watch an author talk and we're like this, like wondering if they're going to tell us how to do it. And then people ask us and we're like, oh, we don't. And so we're all in this game, and the truth is we can only do it.
That's true. There was a hand over there. Oh.
Any other?
Yes, sir.
Is there any books that you would want to adapt to a movie? Have you ever thought about adapting any of your books into a movie?
A lot of them have been, so I think most of them have been optioned. So optioned is kind of the very first, and I don't, you guys might know, I'll speak to you as if you don't know, because I didn't know before this happened to me, but a book will be optioned, and that means that they basically, a production company will say, I would like to give you some money to take your book off the table for anyone else. And for a period of time, we have the exclusive option to make it into a series. So they might say for 18 months, you know, we're going to go and see if we can get actors and money and blah, 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 blah. And then they either get to the end of the 18 months and they say, yes, bam, let's go, let's do it. Or more likely they'll say, oh, we're not quite there yet, let's roll it over. And then they give you a bit more money. No. Some people just have it rolling over and over and it's just like free money. But what would be better is that they would come back and say, yes, we're going to make it into a series. And, you know, it's just this kind of, you know, ongoing thing. So I have had I can't say this last one, and we're being recorded. So, but The Younger Wife, The Good Sister, The Mother-in-Law, and Uncharted Waters, which is my short story that I wrote this year, have all been optioned during that early stages of seeing if something is happening, and we just hope that it'll get to the next stage. And I mean, I would love it. Like, wouldn't that be awesome to see? And I wouldn't want to write the screenplay because I'm not a control freak like that. And I actually love, I mean, I respect people that are control freaks. I'm not good at controlling someone, but I love the idea that someone smarter and better than me can take it, who's good at writing screenplays, because that's not my thing. I love narrative. And screenplays are quite different, but that they might get their hands on it and make it better and make me look good. That's what I like.
Better good than them.
Yeah.
Yay. All right. Is there a final question anywhere? Aha, was you?
Oh, that pressure. Final question.
No, it better be good.
I'm not as smart as that. I was just going to ask, do you have a favorite book, or is it like your current one? Yeah. And if it's your current one, then what was the hardest one to write?
Oh, you know, I used to say The Mother-in-Law was my favorite, and I love things about that. Then the Good Sister was my favorite because of the character of Fern. The things that you love. I love The Soulmate. And you know, if I was to pick an overall book, like, it's not a character, it's not a, I love the way that it really came to me as a moment, as with the idea. And I feel like I did what I set out to do. And I felt like my biggest fear in life is boring people, right? I have a very low tolerance for being bored myself. I don't like to bore people. And I feel like what I did with The Soulmate is that I don't think you'd be bored. You might not like it, but, like, things are happening, you know? And at the heart of it, which I like to do, you were exploring a relationship. It wasn't just the plot, but you hopefully are kind of pondering things. So I really love that about The Soulmate. And I mean, I find it hard to use the word favorite, but then I'm also, I've just turned in my next book, my next year's book, and there's something about that most recent one that you've done, that the characters are still very alive, and that make me excited to, you know, be doing this next year, and, you know, and hope that you know, readers will connect with that one too. But I think probably if I had to choose, I would say The Soulmate. And I'm not just saying that because I might be boring. I really.
It's great that you're so pleased with it. I'm so proud of it. You know, I mean, because, you know, somebody said, Robert Emerson is a wonderful author, said years ago, I know I've said this many, many times, many of you have heard me say it, that every book has three forms. There's the form, there's the ideal form that the author wants to write, that the author has in his or her head. Then there's the book they actually write, which is not the platonic ideal book. Then there's the book that each one of you reads, and every one of you reads the book differently. So every one of you reads the book in your own special way. So the book then takes on thousands, millions of lives of its own. And, you know, it must be really unnerving for authors, I often think, you know, because they have their vision. They did the best they could to execute it, but then it becomes your book. And it really is your book at this point. It isn't her book anymore. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's why we're all here, right? To, you know, admire that. So it is hard to pick a favorite. That comes up a lot. And it's probably because each one's a unique journey.
Yeah.
Notice I didn't say very unique.
Yeah, good.
It's unique or it isn't.
Really?
There are no comparatives for unique. The New York Times has failed to notice that recently.
Oh,
there we are. Yep. So we've come to the part where
that's my mom's pen pee. Very unique.
My husband just goes berserk when that happens.
Yeah.
We're going to thank all of you very much for coming, and we're going to give you a book. So let's see, Jacob, where are we there? 22. Great. So there's a wonderful author called Elliot Pattison, who you may not know, and he won the Edgar for a book called Skull Mantra many years ago, which I'm happy to say I figured out that he might do, so I bought a zillion signed copies from him. And they're set in Tibet, or the border between China and Tibet, and I think one of the most brilliant series, but it became eventually too difficult to try to write about it because China was not happy with people traveling to Tibet and other stuff. But anyway, this isn't Skull Mantra. This is another book in the series called Water Touching Stone. And Elliot, in thanking us for our support, sent us a bunch of his books himself so that we could give them away to you. Mm-hmm. Notice that we're not charging you for it. We're actually giving it away. That was the contract that we had with Elliot. So I would like you, Sally, to pick a number between 1 and 22.
7.
anybody have a seven? Which is not in your, if you don't have a ticket in your, right. And sometimes that person isn't here because they might have bought the book but didn't show up. No,
wait,
seven?
Wait a minute. Somebody seven. We talked about it. Okay.
It wasn't for this one.
Oh.
Ah, okay. Well, that means you should pick a different
number. Go again. 13.
Uh-huh. Okay. You get to go home with Sally's book, and you also get to go home with, and I'm not even sure, is Skull Mattress still in print, paper?
Amazing, kind of.
It's just an amazing book. I can't write. It's your publisher, your very own publisher. I don't know if you can get it, but honestly, if you're at all interested in international stories, and what's really intriguing for those of us here in Arizona is that there is a connection between the Tibetans and the Navajo, and that comes into play in some of the later books. There is a Navajo character who arrives on the scene in Tibet, and it begins when Chinese person who's been in prison in the gulag, so to speak, the Tibetan gulag, because he disagreed with the party, has a chance to get out. It really is just a fabulous book. So anyway, let's thank Sally for coming.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.